From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 9th day of September 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group. He's in Decatur, Illinois. In agricultural news, the Obama administration has released a report critical of corn production as it relates to the hypoxia zone in the Gulf of Mexico. Farmland in the developing world is going up in price, and OPEC expects world demand for oil will slow this year and next. We'll have details of these and other stories shortly. And then in the second half hour of our program, we call that the farming world, we'll talk with Eric Rund, Champaign County farmer, about his adventures with Miscanthus. Eric was at the EBI Energy Tour this morning. I caught up with him and had a bit of a discussion about what he sees as the future of the biofuels crop. And it all happens right here on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois.
The Closing Market Report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from L&M Commodities, a full-service brokerage company serving area farmers with professional market advice and crop insurance products. L&M Commodities has offices in New Market, Indiana, Leland, Illinois, and Terrell, Arkansas.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Thursday afternoon. Checking the numbers from Chicago, September wheat at $7.06¾, a gain today of 28 cents. December at $7.38, up 27. March at $7.66¼, up 27. And next year's July contract from the wheat at $7.38¾, 17 and three quarters of a cent higher. September in the hard red at $7.47½, up 27 and one quarter. September corn, $4.56¼, 8¾ higher. December harvest month at $4.70¾, up 8¼. March corn at $4.84, 8 cents higher. The May at $4.87½, up 6¾. July at $4.89¾, up 5¼. And December at $4.57¼ for next year, 7½ cents higher. September beans at $10.37¾, down 3½. November at $10.46, 2¾ lower. January at $10.55¼, down 3. And July at $10.69¼, a penny and a half lower in the bean pit. Bean meal, September at $3.05.50, down $1.80. Oil at $41.08, down 8 cents on the afternoon. Mercantile exchange numbers, October live cattle, $96.90, down 35 cents. December at $99.65, down 50. Feeders at $111.42½, or 67½ cents lower. And lean hogs today at $77.37½, up $1.07½. This is the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures, October contract, $74.28 a barrel, down 39 cents for the day. Ethanol at $1.92¢, up 2¢. Natural gas at $3.77½, 3¢ lower. October heating oil or diesel fuel at $2.06¢, down 1¢. And the gold futures on the day down $6.70 an ounce at $1,248.90. The Dow Jones Industrial Average now stands at 10,410, just about 24 points higher. And the dollar is up 0.12 at 82.68 for the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast for the Urbana-Champaign area sounds like for the afternoon. As reported by the National Weather Service on this beautiful day, skies are mostly sunny. A high should be around 76 degrees outside, with light winds out of the east, maybe around 7 miles an hour. Tonight, a 30% chance of showers after 1 o'clock in the morning, mostly cloudy, a low around 55, east winds at 7 miles an hour. And tomorrow, Friday, a 50% chance of showers, mostly cloudy, a high near 72, east-southeast winds between 8 and 10 miles an hour. Friday night, 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms for Urbana-Champaign again, mostly cloudy, a low of 62. Saturday, another 50% shot at showers and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy, a high near 81. Saturday night, partly cloudy, a low of 55. Sunday, it'll be sunny, a return to clear skies, a high near 81. Sunday night, mostly clear, a low of 55. And Monday, mostly sunny, a high near 82 degrees with a low of 56 on Monday. We'll take a more complete look at the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour. Pete Levitt is away, so the folks at Chesapeake Energy in Chicago will join us. Stay with us for that part of the Closing Market Report from Urbana-Champaign.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Urbana-Champaign. I'm Todd Gleason. On the phone line with us today, Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group. He's in Decatur, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Dan.
Hi, Todd.
Tell me, let's start. Last week, you spent 3 days in Boone, Iowa at the Farm Progress Show. Did you learn anything from the producers?
Well, I would say it was interesting to talk to the Iowa farmers and Minnesota farmers. They felt fairly confident that they had a good yield sitting out there in the field yet to be harvested. And there's no doubt that Iowa and Minnesota had some of the best-looking crops. But as we hear yield reports coming in from those areas, those farmers are now being disappointed. Yields are coming in anywhere from 20 to 40 bushels under last year in some of those isolated areas. So I think it kind of feels as though they are kind of getting the same medicine that what we felt here in the Eastern Corn Belt, where their crops look good, crop rating levels look good, but once you get into the field, you find out that the bushels are just not there yet.
Does it give you impetus to think about what the number should be actually tomorrow from USDA? And I suppose what you think the number ought to be and what the number could be might be two different things.
Well, what I think doesn't really make a lot of difference. I think the trade, let's put it this way, the trade, I think, is looking for a significant decline. And I think the average trade guess here is only about 163 bushels per acre. But I think deep down everybody feels this that 163 is slipping away very quickly and much further down the ladder. So I think it's one of these things that if it comes in at 163 and above, I think the trade ain't necessarily going to believe it, or they're just going to say, well, it's just going to take USDA another 30 days to catch up, because they feel this crop is much smaller, and at some point in time we're going to have to ration supplies. So I think the bulls could very well rule the day. The thing that you have to worry about, though, is the market is considered in what I would call overbought technical status. But when you're in a very strong fundamental picture, that don't really make a lot of difference for a 2 or 3 week period.
What if USDA comes about and says it's still 165?
I think they'll laugh at them, and the bulls will run right through the defense. Technically, I think the techies are all got their sights set on something up here in this 505-510 area, and I think longer term you're going to hear an awful lot of talk about $6 corn. As time goes on, I think the only thing that's going to stop that is if the market all of a sudden begins to hear a whole bunch of 250 bushel type corn yields, and if there's some out there, I haven't heard any of those yet.
So we may end up with a point where we're rationing a very large crop, despite the fact that it might drop in size to 163 or 160 or 158 or wherever that is. That it's still a good size crop here in the United States, and demand would be big. What dollar amount starts to ration it out? Does $6 do it? Does $5.50? Does $5.05?
I don't think $5 does anything. I think usually when you get into an emotional situation, if that is going to be the case, you want to preface everything because we're just getting started in harvest. But if the trade really gets firmed up on some of these yield numbers that this crop is down, maybe as small as what Informa Economics came out with here a week ago or so, I think this market will explode to the upside in search of trying to reach a price level that would slow demand interest. And my guess is $5 won't do it. I think you usually have to go to the extreme, and I think that would be, you know, something, you know, at least the 5.5 or more level. But we'll just have to kind of wait and see. Like I said, harvest is early, but the reports that I have heard so far come out of Iowa and Nebraska are all kind of on the disappointing side also.
Okay, so let's move to the soy complex. Is there any reason that soybeans would stay in step with corn on the way up, or is just the number of bushels that will be left at the end of the year a big enough supply that where we're at, that $10 and above range is enough to hold the bean market?
Well, the demand that we're seeing out of Asia is just super, super strong, and it requires not only a big crop out of the U.S., it's going to require a big crop out of South America and another big crop out of the U.S. next year. So I think what beans could get caught into is that the market is going to be so short of corn that corn is going to lead the rally, and it will eventually pull acres away from soybeans, or I think the corn market is going to try to get to a level that we plant 90, 91 million acres of corn. And I know a lot of these guys that have planted corn on corn, they're getting their teeth kicked in so bad this year that it's going to take a very attractive new crop corn price probably to get those guys to keep coming back at corn on corn. And I think once that happens, if that is the case, all of a sudden you're going to look around and you're going to say, where's the bean acres? And beans may have to stay competitive in an acreage, so-called acreage battle that I think could very well happen this fall, not necessarily next spring.
Okay, and then turn your attention to the wheat market. A rough day there yesterday, but they recovered it all and a bit more today.
Yeah, I think I'm mostly watching new crop wheat because I think that's the big animal right now as we look ahead. I mean, when you look at the calendar and everything, we're in the process of planting the new crop. New crop Chicago July, I think, sliced right through, or it's right up against this 50% level that it declined. It had a high here a few weeks ago at 799, dropped down here to 684. That's about $1.15 decline, and I think we're right at that 50% level. If I think wheat starts plowing above this 50% level, I think that opens the door then for a move on up through 799. I think it kind of depends on how bullish you want to be on corn.
Right.
If you're a buck bullish on corn, well, wheat's going to go $1.50 or more along with it, I think.
So in your mind, is corn the leader at this point, and will it remain the leader in the pits?
It is at the moment, because that's the one we're harvesting, and that's the one the market is reacting to as a short crop. We'll have to kind of go from there. I mean, wheat was somewhat of a leader earlier, but corn is definitely what I call as a leader. You can just kind of look at the charts. Corn is making right up against highs for the year. Wheat is underneath their highs, you know, and when you're making new calendar year highs in late September, you know something is up, and it's basically a short crop.
You know, let me ask you one other question. If wheat were to become the leader, what does that signal to you about the corn market and sales that producers might want to make at that time, if at all? And I'm not saying they're suggesting they should, but is it a cue?
Well, I did a quick glance of all of these market advisory services where they're all priced at and what they've done. They've got these farmers all sold up down here in this $3.90, $4 level, anywhere between 60 and 100% of their corn. So we're even finding out in many areas farmers are oversold because of their harvest is coming in smaller, so they're having to buy back some contracts. So we're seeing that, and I think we're just seeing the start of that. If wheat would become the leader, you could probably be $9 type bullish wheat. And if you want to be $9 bullish wheat, then you're going to be talking about $5.50, $6 bullish corn. And, we got it would be a major bull market on our hands here to finish out 2010 and start early in 2011 or so.
Dan, thanks so much.
Very well.
You have a good day.
Bye.
Dan Zwicker is with ADM Grain Group. He's in Decatur, Illinois. Joins us here on the Closing Mark Report. That one happens each and every Thursday afternoon.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Dave Dickey is here now with today's agricultural news.
In agricultural news, the Obama administration has released an interagency report on hypoxia in the Gulf of Mexico and other coastal waters that is critical of agriculture's role in the dead zone, especially through corn production. The report cites nutrient runoff from agricultural fields, especially nitrogen and phosphorus, as one of the major factors causing hypoxia. The report cites the 36-billion-gallon renewable fuels standard, which includes 15 billion gallons from ethanol, as a driver to boost corn production and thus nitrogen runoff. The World Bank says fears over food security have fueled a surge in investment in farmland in the developing world, and growing price volatility is likely to boost the trend. The report says, spurred by the 2008 food crisis and continued food price volatility, the number of large-scale farmland deals amounted to 45 million hectares in 2009, compared with an average expansion rate of 4 million hectares a year in the decade leading up to 2008. OPEC's monthly oil market report today says that world demand for OPEC's oil will be lower than expected this year and next due to a slowing economic recovery and higher supplies from non-member countries. Demand for OPEC crude will average 28.65 million barrels per day in 2010. That is down about 100,000 barrels from last month's forecast. It trimmed next year's forecast, the 28.84 million barrels per day, also down about 100,000 barrels per day from last month. A federal judge has dismissed a lawsuit that accused former Vera Sun Energy Corporation executives of fraud. The class action suit filed by stockholders in the former ethanol company alleged the executives were untruthful about the financial state of the company and the risks involved in the business when it offered 20 million shares of its common stock for sale on September 16th of 2008. That was 1 month before the company filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The judge ruled that Vera Sun adequately warned investors. Japan today says that it plans to sign a free trade pact with India that will end tariffs on 94% of traded goods over 10 years. The two countries reached an agreement at sub-cabinet-level trade talks in Tokyo. Both sides still need to finalize details. Kyoto News Agency says the two countries aim to sign the agreement in October. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Mark Report and Commodity Week. Both programs you can hear anytime you'd like off our website. The address is WILL. willag.org. That's willag.org. There you'll find all of our agricultural programming from the pre-opening market report to the closing market report, plus Commodity Week, all for free, all in their entirety, posted not long after they're produced and aired on the radio stations. Commodity Week, in fact, is posted to the website before it airs on any radio station at about 6 p.m. on Friday evenings. Now, up next, you know, the University of Florida, like the University of Illinois, does a lot of research, and they've been looking into Asian soybean rust. That's a problem that farmers here in the Midwest were worried about a few years ago when it first managed to make its way into the nation. It hasn't been a big problem in Illinois or many other places for the nation, but that doesn't mean it's not a threat. And the University of Florida folks have found kind of a sweet way to deal with Asian soybean rust. Rod Bain from the United States Department of Agriculture has more.
Asian soybean rust has been a major threat to the soybean industry since its arrival into the U.S. in 2004. But now research at the University of Florida may have found a sweet way to control this fungal-based disease.
Saccharin has been used on other plants to induce this type of resistance. We tried that right away, and it does.
That's Jim Arwah, a University of Florida plant pathology professor. And yes, he says saccharin, the same artificial sweetener used in everything from soft drinks to toothpaste, is proven to work to fight Asian soybean rust.
The application of the saccharin, it induces a plant response, kind of like what we do if we're vaccinated. The plant becomes more resistant to a lot of different kinds of diseases after it has this particular chemical stimulation.
The reaction, systemic acquired resistance, also occurs when similar compounds are applied to plants.
Saccharin, by chance, is very similar to a common chemical that the plant produces naturally to induce this response. So we kind of tricked the plant into thinking that it was being attacked by a pathogen by putting this chemical, the saccharin, on. So then once that happened, the whole plant becomes resistant to the disease.
Marwah says various chemicals along with saccharin have been used on tobacco, beans, barley, and cucumbers to successfully induce and stimulate systemic acquired resistance.
So the next thing then is to scale that up, find a chemical that may be cheaper or easier to apply that works in a similar way. Or maybe we'll end up using saccharin, we don't know. But now that we know that the mechanism is there and that the phenomenon exists, we need to put it into a field production system because we have 75 million acres of soybeans out there, and we need to find some way to protect them from the soybean rust.
Now he adds that saccharin could be used as a complement to fungicides as a tool to ward off Asian soybean rust.
It would depend on how much disease pressure the area is under. This is something that helps the plant to be resistant to the disease, but if you have extreme disease pressure, you may need to complement it with a fungicide. So if you're in an area where disease pressure is very light, this could be a standalone. But it's more likely that if you're in an area like the southeast where we've got a lot more disease pressure from soybean rust, you may have to use this technique in combination with other chemicals. But you wouldn't have to use as much of the other more traditional fungicides, is what we're thinking.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Todd Gleason in Urbana-Champaign from Illinois Public Media at willag.org. Coming up in 2 minutes, we'll talk with the folks at Chesapeake Energy in Chicago about the agricultural weather forecast. And then after that, on many of these radio stations during the farming world, Eric Rund will join us. I spoke with him this morning from the EBI, the Energy Biosciences Institute Energy Farm Tour. Eric has been using miscanthus and doing a bit more than messing around with it in the field for the past 3 years and has some ideas on its uses in the future. It's an interesting conversation. Hope you can stay with us for the farming world. Back in a couple of minutes.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
On this day in agricultural history in 1754, William Bligh was born. He became captain of the English ship Bounty, and while sailing to Tahiti to bring back breadfruit trees, the most famous mutiny in history took place. In 1843, a patent was issued for a new hand-cranked ice cream freezer. Nancy Johnson's design added a vertical shaft with curved paddles, reaching nearly to the inside walls. The design quickened the freezing process. In 1890, Harland Sanders was born near Henryville, Indiana. He was, of course, better known as Colonel Sanders, founder of the Kentucky Fried Chicken fast food restaurant chain. In 1917, Edward Johnson died, an American electrical engineer and inventor. He once served as vice president of Thomas Edison's Edison Electric Light Company, but he may be best known for creating the first electric lights on a Christmas tree. And in 1995, Orville Redenbacher died. Born on a farm in Brazil, Indiana, he began growing his own popping corn at age 12, and after earning a Bachelor of Sciences degree in agriculture from Purdue University, he developed the popcorn hybrid that made him famous. And that's This Day in Agricultural History.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Rebecca King in Galesburg at 309-341-5007. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
This is the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media, the U of I campus in Urbana-Champaign. I'm Todd Gleason on the phone line with us from Chicago in the Boeing building up on the 23rd floor. Josh Darr of Chesapeake Energy filling in today for the absent, Mr. Pete Levitt. Thanks so much, Josh, for taking the time with us. We do appreciate that.
My pleasure, Todd.
Weekend. I'd like to have a good one. That could mean rain, actually, I suppose, for some. Sunshine for others. Which will it be?
It is looking like it's a little bit of both, actually. We have a couple components to the forecast here. Across southern parts of the state of Illinois, here later this afternoon, the remnants of Tropical Storm Hermine, which dropped over 10 inches of rain in Austin, Texas, earlier this week. The remnants are moving across the Ohio River starting late this afternoon through tomorrow. So that'll be a minor rain event across the southern parts of the state of Illinois. Then we have a front come through. It looks like it comes through during the day on Saturday. Not a significant wind temperature change behind the front. It's going to be more of rain and just a wind shift. That looks to last Saturday, but then we do start to clear on Sunday. And Sunday looks like it could be just a gorgeous early autumn afternoon here in the Midwest. High pressure builds in, highs in the 70s, maybe some upper 60s in the northern parts of Illinois. And just looks like one of those classic early fall days on Sunday.
If you had to say across the Midwest for the weekend, how much rainfall might there be, and will it be really worth reporting on?
If you had to pick a bullseye of the heaviest amounts, you would probably go for southwestern Iowa. If the amount's up to an inch in the southwestern, say, corner or quarter of Iowa. Other than that, really, Todd, it's one of these frontal passages that will drop maybe a couple tenths of inch of rain across most of the belt, and then bring it further east, less amounts, less coverage. So it's really not going to be an event to write home about. So, shouldn't impact any early harvest.
And then back to harvest on Sunday and Monday, I suppose. What after that?
After that, it looks pretty quiet till we get to Wednesday and Thursday when we have another front moving across the belt. And like many of these fronts we've seen actually all the way back through August, this looks to be a better rain producer in the western and northern parts of the belt than southern and eastern parts of the belt. So as the front comes through Illinois, the precip starts to die out. And by the time you get into Indiana, by the way, second driest August on record, then the precip dies down. That's a trend we have seen since back in late July.
Okay, and then take me a little further west into the Great Plains states to talk about setting up for their production for next year and sowing wheat this fall.
I'll tell you what, some areas dodged a bullet with Hermine. Only 20% of the hard red wheat belt from Texas up to Nebraska caught measurable rainfall out of the remnants of Hermine. It looks like a very good weekend on tap for early planting in that area. Next rainfall prospects would be with that front Thursday next week, and that looks more of a Nebraska, northern Kansas. So conditions look good to stay in the fields.
Thanks much, Josh.
Thanks, Todd.
Josh Darr with Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois, joining us here on the Closing Mark Report. Stay with us if you can for the farming world. You're listening to The Farming World from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, coming to you on tape today from the Energy Farm Tour. Eric Rund, farmer from Champaign County, sits down with me this morning to talk just a bit about the kind of work he's been doing with some of the energy crops that, well, the University of Illinois is looking at as well. Miscanthus is among those. Eric, thank you so much for being with us today.
Good morning, Todd. Good to see you this morning.
Tell me about the type of work you've been doing on your farm with miscanthus, how long you've had it on the farm, what it's like to work with as a crop.
Yeah, we got interested about 3 years ago when I listened to Dr. Long speak on campus and had lunch with him afterwards, and he had a baker's dozen of miscanthus plants and planted them on the farm. And to me, it looked real interesting because when you do the numbers, you can get about three times the energy for ethanol, if you're converting to ethanol, off of miscanthus than you could with corn. So I thought if we're going to raise energy, which we seem to be doing with the corn, let's pick a crop that's going to return the most. And so that's kind of the focus then I took, is let's see how you grow miscanthus, what's involved, is it feasible here in central Illinois or southern Illinois or wherever. And kept up with it for a couple of years and finally really got interested to the point that we were going to invest something in it. And so this year, January, I met with Dean Thiessen of New Energy Farms out of Canada. Struck a deal to where we will buy plants from him, and we planted 15 acres this year of seed stock, miscanthus.
So you've got seed stock on your farm. It has a, and I don't know whether it's a hybrid or it's their personal line, or but it does have a name, much like most yes. Hybrids would, or from plants that producers would be used mm-hmm. to working with.
Yes, the most of what's grown in Illinois, as far as well North America, as far as I know, is the Illinois clone, is what they call it. There's a lot of working on other varieties, but that's the most prevalent. If you call prevalent, there's very little miscanthus actually grown in Illinois so far in North America. So it's the Illinois clone. And what we planted was not just on our own farm, but we planted some for Parkland College, City of Tuscola, City of Decatur, several farmers around, General Mills up in Rochelle, companies and individuals and municipalities that were interested in eventually going to a biomass source of energy for not necessarily ethanol, but just to burn it. So we got interested and changed focus, actually, from ethanol to burning it, because we went to Europe last year, my son and I, and toured Germany, Austria, UK, and Ireland. Everywhere there, no one's looking at ethanol from miscanthus. They burn it directly. And because there's a lot of wood burning already in Austria, Germany, in Europe, miscanthus fit right in. It just replaces one-to-one the wood chips they're burning now. Much more efficiently, yields more, and gives farmers an opportunity to actually have another cash crop. So came back home with another focus on what we're going to grow this for. And it also, because of just burning it, was the focus. It makes it more democratic, if you will. Anybody can light a match to it and burn it. You don't need millions of dollars to build a cellulosic ethanol plant, which is kind of a distant technology anyway. So here we are. I can heat my house. There were Germans that sold miscanthus to their local school district, and they were heating the school district. There, in the town where they were from, there was actually a district power plant that burned miscanthus. So there's opportunities. I could see that there were opportunities for locally grown energy used locally, which would not only help the energy situation, but have a community involvement that wouldn't change the landscape so much, like a 100 million gallon cellulosic ethanol plant moving into the area. If you think about that, if some such thing like that came in, they would look to have most of the acres around it grown in miscanthus. Well, that would change the whole community. You would no longer grow corn. You'd be one crop a year miscanthus. And while as that may work, I wouldn't look forward to a change like that. And the approach the Europeans are taking or were doing at the time seemed like a lot more practical, sensible, something we could do in the short term on a smaller and much smaller investment as well. So it's kind of a long story of where I got to where I am now, but the focus is no longer ethanol, it's direct burning. What else we learned in Europe was it's no longer, we want to go out and bale this stuff. Baling's expensive. I've grown corn and beans most of my whole life. But you go out and try to hire somebody to bale it, it's $21 a ton. Well, at 14 times the acre yield, you're talking close to $300 just for baling. Well, there's got to be a cheaper way to harvest miscanthus or you won't be able to do it. So the Germans and Austrians were both using silage choppers. They go out, chip it basically, little inch and a half pieces, blow it into a silage wagon. Wagon goes to the edge of the field, dumps it in a big pile. They either tarp it or they don't tarp it. Depends on when they're going to pick it up. And that's harvest and storage. Very cheap, very doable here. It makes the whole process make sense. Now, you can't do that everywhere, but if you're providing fuel for a local school district or a local power plant or somewhere where you keep the production and use close to each other, it works very well. So those two things, the focus of what we're going to use it for and how to harvest, were the most valuable things I learned from those guys. And so now you got to grow it. So that's why one of the reasons I'm here at this field day today.
Tell me about the number of acres you planted in the last year, and then I want to talk a bit more about the burning process.
We planted, we represent New Energy Farms in Illinois, okay? And their process, and what I've learned from Dean Thiessen, the head of that company, is we'll plant, and what we did, we planted 16,000 plants per acre this year, 30-inch rows, about a foot apart. In 2 years, the spring of 2012, we'll come in with what's called a rhizome lifter. It looks like a rototiller with a chain on the back, like for digging potatoes. This thing comes in, tears up the soil, tears up the rhizomes, throws them on this chain, sifts the dirt out, and then the rhizomes then go into a specialized planter that will spread this then over what is going to be your biomass acres. This process, from every acre of seed stock we plant now at 16,000 per acre, in 2 years we can plant 50 to 60 acres of biomass production. So essentially what we're doing now is growing our seed for future biomass acres. So like some of the farmers I planted this for, they plant an acre of this. In 2 years, they'll have enough for 50 acres of biomass to plant. A few numbers. I'm a little leery about giving out numbers because things change in 3 years. And also, I know just enough to be dangerous on this. But in 2 years, they'll go out and plant this. And if you add up the cost they spent on the rhizomes to plant the original 16,000 plants per acre, all the machinery costs, the herbicide, the labor, and everything, and go out and plant, take that 1 acre and plant your 50 acres, divide all those costs, what it costs to do that, and you're about $650 maybe an acre to establish a biomass crop, which is not that far from what we're spending now sometimes, if you include all the labor and machinery to put a corn crop in. Advantage is it's a one-shot deal. You plant it, and it's a perennial. It's going to be there for a while. So the economics are not only does it make sense, but the economics begin to make sense now. I did some rough figuring in at 200 bushel corn at 450, I can match that with miscanthus at $50 a ton. Corn gets above that, well, you're better off growing corn. Gets below that, and you're better, more profit in miscanthus. So the way I look at it here in central Illinois, it's a third crop for me. Okay, it's not going to replace corn or beans. But in those areas where maybe I have CRP acres now that are going out of contract, or a little rougher ground that didn't quite qualify for CRP, but it's not real good corn ground, good place for miscanthus. Like square up some fields, take advantage of these areas, and still earn what I'm earning on corn now. So,
let's go back to to burning miscanthus. The first thing that popped in my mind when you suggested burning miscanthus was actually cogeneration at coal-fired power plants. Right. But you're really talking much more local so that the school district might have its own external power plant that may or may not be able to provide enough energy for the whole place.
Right. Yeah. One of the first people who approached us on this 2 years ago was Duke Energy. They got a small power plant. Well, they've got power plants all over the U.S. They're the third largest energy producer from coal in the U.S. But they're looking at the possibility of replacing 10% of the coal with a biomass. They would do that in 3 months, December, January, February, in the winter. And so that sounded real interesting. If they had the technology to do that, which I've seen it in Europe, so I know it can be done, then it's perfect for miscanthus, because miscanthus harvest is December, January, February, and maybe some of March. So you don't have much storage. You harvest it, haul it to the plant, and you're done, just gradually through the winter. So that sounded real interesting, and we've continued to talk with them, and I think something's going to come of that. In fact, we planted a half acre for Lyondell Bacell, which is a chemical plant west of Tuscola, who get their power from a small Duke Energy power plant down there. They've got some ground, and maybe eventually they may start growing some of their own fuel to fuel their plant. It's certainly possible if you look at what the Europeans are doing.
And this question may be out of your bailiwick just a bit, but I'll make some assumptions here that if you're cogenerating at a coal-fired power plant, part of the reason for the cogeneration is that it burns cleaner as a total. But if you have small plants, what are the environmental problems, if any, from burning just miscanthus?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a question we asked too, and as in Austria in particular, we were asking these questions. They have more stringent regulation than we have, actually. And the smaller plants have less stringent regulations, but they're still stringent. A home residence burner burns very clean and meets all their regulations. The one we saw for the school district was the same way, no problem at all. So there are these possibilities, and we're talking to Illinois EPA about how this may fit into what our regulations are here now.
We're talking this afternoon with Eric Rund here on The Farming World. More with him when we return. I'm Todd Gleason.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development today says that the global recovery looks to be slowing more than expected as growth weakens in rich economies, and stimulus should be extended or stepped up if the slowdown endures. OECD forecast growth across the G7 group of major economies to average an annualized 1.4% in the third quarter and 1% in the fourth, down from 3.2% and 2.5% in the first and second quarters, respectively. The OEDC forecast annualized U.S. growth rates of 2 and 1.2% in the third and fourth quarters, after 1.6% in the second quarter and 3.7% in the first. Meanwhile, a survey of the Federal Reserve released yesterday found the slower growth spreading to more regions of the country. Of the 12 regions the Fed tracks, economic activity slowed or was mixed in 5: New York, Philadelphia, Richmond, Atlanta, and Chicago. In the Fed's previous survey in late July, only 2 regions, Atlanta and Chicago, had reported slower growth. Cereal and snack food maker General Mills yesterday affirmed its full-year guidance of $2.46 to $2.48 a share and said it does not expect first quarter net income to rise from a year ago. The company plans to report first quarter results on September 22nd. And that's a look at today's business news.
This is the Farming World from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. Champaign County farmer Eric Rund joins us today, actually this morning when we're recording here, on the Energy Farm Tour sponsored by the U of I, just south of campus. Rund has been in the process of working with miscanthus, that's an energy crop potentially, in the United States, and he's done that for a couple, 2 or 3 years. When we last spoke with him, we were talking about what I will call dispersed energy production in a local area, so that miscanthus would be raised in his ideas locally and then used and burned locally to power things, for instance, like a high school.
Yes. For example, A local school is about the right size for 100 acres of biomass production, what you could raise on that. You'd approach the school district, say, we'll get the grid. There are many grants available for this type of thing. Put in a biomass boiler right outside the other side of the wall from your present natural gas boiler. You don't want to get rid of your natural gas because this is all new stuff. If it quits, you don't want to have to cancel school because you don't have the biomass burner working. So that's the kind of project that would really have local farmers given the opportunity to provide fuel for their local school district. It just makes a lot of sense. It's small, it's doable, there's money available, and I think it's going to go that direction first. Now, the idea of larger production is very feasible, but not necessarily in central Illinois. I was down in Metropolis, Illinois, about 6 months ago and stood there and looked out over the trees. You can see the Ohio, I think it was in Ohio, but it was on the Ohio River, big coal-fired power plant. And then you look around, get up in a plane and fly around, there's all these grassy knolls, hilltops that you really can't grow corn on. And a perfect place for miscanthus to be grown. You got large acreages close to a big power plant, or it could be a cellulosic processor when that system comes online. But in those kinds of areas, the farmers there who struggle to make money with corn actually can plant miscanthus and do better because in the trials U of I has done thus far, miscanthus does better in southern Illinois than it does here in the central part, simply because the weather, the climate's more suited to it. The season's longer, so it yields more. So there you have 150 bushel corn yields maybe in some of that area. Instead of corn, you plant miscanthus, and run it to a cellulosic ethanol plant, or if U of I continues their work, they're going to have fuels not only be like ethanol, be what they're calling now drop-in fuels. There will actually be cellulosic gasoline or gasoline similar to where you won't have to worry about pipelines and all that sort of thing. So the work they're doing here at EBI may come up with something that's going to be a lot better even than what we have now with ethanol. But you want to be careful where you put the plants. Put them where the land is suited to growing it, large acreages, and areas where you're not going to completely upset the community that's there now. And so there's many options to this. That's the whole idea that any kind of biomass production of energy is very democratic. Because there's all sorts of ideas you can do. There's wood. There's all the work they're doing here with the new wood crops, and all these ideas will work, or can work. At least they have an opportunity to work, and that's what's exciting about this.
It's the kind of thing that really decentralizes the electric grid. Because in my discussions with folks that were hoping to put cellulosic plants together, they usually talk about 20 million gallon plants. Not 100 million gallon plants, because of the area that they have to draw the cellulosic or the woody type of plant from needs to be really localized, because the storage happens on the farm, or needs to be dispersed. If you put it all together, it takes up a large amount of space in one area, and it's kind of hard to handle when it's all put in one place too. So it really is very democratic, as you're saying. I take it you have faith that this is the right way to go.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. I think I've run the numbers myself. It looks good here, and they're doing it in Europe, in Germany. I learned more from one German farmer in 3 hours than I learned in 3 years on my own here, simply because he's been doing it. With most machinery and new things, farmers, when they actually have to go do it or use that particular piece of equipment, they're the innovators. And these farmers in Germany and Austria had to do this, and they've come up with all different kinds of variations of equipment and how to handle the miscanthus, and they've learned a lot. And we're at that stage now where we're going to start learning that same thing. What they're doing here at this energy farm is a great thing, because finally you've got enough acres that you can start trying these ideas. There's some good work being done here. And as it gets out to farmers, they're going to take that and they're going to add their own innovation to it. And we'll learn from each other. At least I hope we will. So,
thank you very much, Eric, for being with us today.
Well, you're welcome. Glad to be here and glad to talk to you.
Eric Rund is a farmer in Champaign County, visited with us this morning on the Energy Farm Tour sponsored by the EBI. It is funded in part by BP and a cooperative effort between the University of California, Berkeley, and the University of Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason. This has been The Farming World.